ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I'm Alan Kohler, and I want to take you straight to the source. Every Friday, I sit down with the people running companies, shaping industries, and influencing the Australian economy to talk risk, power, profit, pressure, not just their success, but their strategy and what it means for the rest of us. Because that's business. Search, subscribe, and stay ahead. Find That's Business with Alan Kohler on the ABC Business Daily feed, on ABC Listen, or wherever you get your podcast.
Today, the Australian people have voted for Australian values.
The choice is simple for the Liberal Party. Change or die.
We need to have more Australian everything. We need to manifest a hyper-Australia.
We've always been about the planet, but we've got to make sure that people have their daily needs met.
People are starting to see that there is actually a different way of doing politics.
Hello and welcome to the Party Room, Question Time edition. I'm Patricia Carvalis, back in my Melbourne studio here on Wurundjeri Country.
And I'm happy for that, PK. And I'm Fran Kelly, here in the Gadigal land of the Eora Nation in Sydney. PK, I just can't believe the huge number of sensational questions we receive from listeners, all of you out there listening. I already knew we had the best audience ever. And I just really want to say now, I appreciate that you bothered to send in your questions. I am in awe of your intellectual capacity. And I really, really love the fact that so many of you tell us you've been listening for a long time. You Party Roomers, we love you and we really appreciate. We're coming up to 10 years now and hopefully we'll have some news about that. But yeah, we really appreciate you being there. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for sticking by us and also for spruiking us to your mates and relatives, because that's, of course, how we grow and, you know, makes us kind of want to keep turning up. So thank you very much. Now, Fran, before we get to those questions that you just talked about, a few developments that I think are pretty significant, actually. Australia has been in the firing line of another Donald Trump spray. Surprise, surprise, another day, another spray. This time, not over social media, but the US president said he was surprised by Australia's refusal to help the US secure the Strait of Hormuz. And I quote, "Australia was not great. I was a little surprised by Australia." Now, Albanese government ministers have avoided being drawn into the remarks. In fact, they, can I just say, they have become rolled gold experts at not being drawn into Trump remarks. So much, so deftly do they handle this that it, as an interviewer, I'm just going to declare it, it's actually very hard to even ask them because they shut it down in a way where, you know, whoever's media managing them, and you're all listening as well, you've done a good job of shutting them down because you get nowhere. But Richard Marles did defend Australia's response. He said, "The one request we've had from the United States is to provide support for the Gulf states, which is, in fact, what we're doing, and that's where we see our national interest." Now, I think that's interesting because even in saying that, he, you know, conceding it's a request from the United States, Penny Wong wouldn't concede that to me over a week ago, and implying in that answer that us helping was to also give them what they wanted, which has not been the line till now. The line has been that it's about helping our mates in the Gulf and Australians stranded there. So that's different. Sarah Henderson hasn't missed an opportunity. She said it was embarrassing to be called out on the world stage. I don't know if everyone will agree with that as the days roll on, though. I mean, we're recording this on a Friday. You've heard over the last week Andrew Hastie being pretty full on about Donald Trump. So I think we will hear different things about the war from the coalition. They won't speak as one either, Fran.
No, and look, I think Sarah Henderson should cast her mind back to the election campaign where Anthony Albanese and Labor did very well by not jumping on the Trump bandwagon, by keeping their distance, by criticising him at points. You know, the Australian people liked that. Peter Dutton made the wrong call at that point by, you know, praising Donald Trump and his intellect and then having to sort of distance himself because the polls show that wasn't popular. So I think that's a lesson that the Albanese government's already learnt. But I also think, as you say, the allies have learnt to manage Donald Trump differently. They started off, you know, managing him and you know, flattering him and getting somewhere like that. But there is no trust left here, I don't think. And that's what we're seeing. And the Allies have, you know, we had the German defense minister in the National Press Club in Canberra yesterday standing up. Let me just read you what he said. He said, "What concerns me most about the war is there was no consultation. One thing. There is no strategy. There is no clear objective. And the worst thing from my perspective is there is no exit strategy." So that's from Germany. That's an ally. That's the attitude in Europe. And Trump is bumping up against that and he doesn't like it. Yes, they haven't helped him because he didn't tell them he was going to do it. Now, Australia will be called on. We are the United States is our major defence ally. And when this war stops, and let's hope it's sooner rather than later, but God knows how that's going to happen, Australia will be called on to, you know, help police some of the region and things like that, as we do now in alliance. But we haven't been asked to send warships. And I don't even think we've got the warships to send, probably. But, you know, I think Trump is just spraying, really.
He's a sprayer. That's what the man does. Look, you know, even the way he's handling this war is just wild. He's given Iran another 10 days to negotiate on ending it. The sort of different messaging from Iran versus the US and the counterclaim about, you know, the president suggesting that Iranian negotiators are just scared of being, you know, killed. That's why they're not admitting that they're negotiating. The whole thing is just a little batshit, I've got to say. I'm sorry, but it is. Like, it's like where what to believe. And truthfully, I think there's a lot of spin on every side and a lot of propaganda coming from Iran as well, to be very fair.
PK, I think, look, you know, you said it yesterday. It's a bit of a binfire wherever you look at the moment, right? Politically, here, outside, you know, Australians are scared.
It's not great,
and nervous,
is it?
It's not great. So I just thought, because this is a special edition, our Question Time edition, and, you know, we're connecting with our beloved listeners right now, I thought maybe we should switch it up a bit and, you know, try and be a little positive. So I know this is going to sound very Pollyanna-ish in the midst of all we're going through, but PK, what's been your favourite story this week? What's uplifted you this week?
Well, this week has been a difficult week, and you just alluded to it. Of course, the war in Iran, the fuel crisis. We had two strikes. You know, my partner was on strike in Victoria here at the ABC. Of course, we had our industrial action. So those things are difficult. So you're right. They're difficult moments.
They're stressful.
They are stressful. They are difficult. They are, you know, conflict is difficult, and that's what is at the heart. So you asked me what's my favourite. Well, I wake up very early. So, you know, when I did breakfast, it wasn't that hard for me because I'm an early waker. So I'm still waking up very early, Fran. I know you do as well. Not quite as early as we did when we both did breakfast.
Thank God.
We're not insane. But we're getting up early. And I got up and I saw that the former Brisbane Lion, whose name is Lee Ryswick, has come out as the first openly gay AFL player, past or present. And I, as a devotee of heated rivalry, now most people listening, I suspect, have now gotten on the heated rivalry bandwagon and see in that amazing show. Fran, have you seen it?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, good. The kind of issues still in elite sports around hypermasculinity and homophobia, that him doing that, he only played one game at the top level, but he played a lot of games at the lower level, you know what I mean, at the next level. Of course, he's not quite the first. Last year, former player Mitch Brown came out as the first bisexual AFL player. Of course, you know, that is also a big deal. But to come out as a gay player, I think, is a big deal. It's the start of something, not the end of something. But the people who go first, and I know this for, and I'm getting a bit personal here, but I think people can handle it. The people who go first pave the way for the rest of us. And, you know, I came out in the late 90s, mid-90s, and that wasn't easy because there was barely anyone that was gay. Now I see the Matildas, and I think if you are, you know, young and gay now, that is representation. If you're a young gay man and you are an athlete, it would be very hard looking at something like the AFL. So I think it's amazing, and I hope there's more of it. And I'll tell you why I hope, not because I want everyone to be gay, you be what you want to be, but because, do the maths, people, there are more gay people. I know, because I know AFL players, and they've told me there are more gay people, that they just aren't comfortable coming out. And as soon as someone is brave enough to share, it opens the door for others. So that was a positive story. There was. It was just one small story. It's small. It's just, you know, a little thing. But to me, it gave me some hope that maybe a culture will change. How about you?
Yeah, and I just think that culture is really stuck, because if you think about it, Ian Roberts came out back in, when was it? 1995, I think, the first rugby league player to come out as gay. And then there was nothing for so many years. So it's, you know, it's clearly very difficult. Well, you know, I had to scratch around a bit, to be honest, PK, to find a positive story this week, because, you know, we're so kind of in the news at the moment and the news is not happy. But there was one bright light. Bondi hero Ahmed Al-Ahmed, he was the one, of course, who attacked the gunman at Bondi. He was awarded the key to Sydney and, get this, a lifetime beach parking pass at Bondi, I think it was, yes, for his bravery during the December 14 terror attack. Now, anyone who's tried to park at Bondi knows that is quite something to have in your back pocket. Can I say it's the very least this man deserves, but I'm really glad he's got it. And I think I hope he and his loved ones get to enjoy a lot of free beach trips over the rest of their lifetime, because you did a wonderful thing for Australia. You really did. So that was my upbeat moment.
Yeah. And there are good things always happening.
We shall move to questions without notice. Are there any questions? I give the call to the Honourable, the Leader of the Opposition.
Yeah.
Prime Minister.
The bells are ringing, Fran. Let's get into question time. This week, our first question comes from Daniel.
Hi, PK and Fran. Daniel from Melbourne here, big time fan. I've been watching the South Australian election and looking at the projected seats at this point in time, there's a chance that the Liberals and One Nation might finish off on the same number of seats in the lower house. If that does happen, who would form opposition? Are there rules around it?
Daniel, that's a really good question, and you are not alone in asking this. We had a few people asking a similar thing coming into the inbox this week. So over the weekend, more people put One Nation as their first preference than the Liberals in South Australia. That's the fact of it. The seat count is still going on, but it looks as though there could be even Stevens. We did consult our resident expert, Casey. The count is still going on, so we don't know, but it could be 4-4. That's how it could be. What does that mean? Well, we don't know. The truth is, I think we don't know. We are in uncharted waters. It has happened once in the Northern Territory Parliament, which is a teeny-weeny parliament. The opposition leader is basically whoever the speaker recognises. But, you know, the House can argue about that. So, look, we really don't know how it's going to work out. This is a very interesting situation to be in. It's bad news, very bad news for the Liberal Party if they don't get to be the official opposition. And it would be another blow for that party, and the Liberal Party broadly and nationally will be looking at that. But it's a really good question. The answer is, as far as I can tell, we don't know. PK, you got any more intel?
No, I'm going with that. Okay, our next question is in a similar vein and comes from Tom.
Hi, Fran. Hi, PK. Thank you so much for doing the best podcast in Australia. My question is more relating to the terminology that we use when we talk about our political parties. For my entire life, and I'm in my mid-30s, the Liberal Party has been one of the two major parties of the nation, and I'm sensing that's beginning to change. When do you think we'll stop referring to them as a major party and perhaps as a minor party? And also, when do you think we'll stop referring to One Nation as a minor party and refer to them as a major party? Thank you.
Really interesting question. I think if the decline continues, Tom, yeah, we're going to have to change our language, of course. I don't think we're there yet, though. And I don't think the numbers show that we're there yet. I mean, looking at the parliament, and I sit, and I go for many sitting weeks for afternoon briefing, and I bring you the pod from there too, and I sit there in the gallery in question time, and I look down, and there are still a sizable, you know, it's a rump compared to what it was, of course, but they are still, you would say, broadly a major-ish party. So, you know, you can't demote them yet, but if the decline continues, of course, they will have to be a party, but that it's a minor party. By the time that happens, though, I imagine you'll see more shifts, a split, a this, a that. You know what I mean? Like, I think we'll see more shifts. I think this political story, bit of drama coming from me, you won't be surprised. This political story is being written. We are in the story. You are sort of somewhere in the middle of it, right, as you're reading a long novel. We're in the middle of it. We are not at the end of it. We're on a journey. How they pivot, what happens next, and it's so linked to world politics, geopolitics, even this war we're seeing, everything frames it. So watch that space. I don't think they're a minor party yet, though.
No, they're not a minor party. It's really as simple as bums on seats, I think, Tom, and that you get major party status while ever you've got a significant number of seats in the lower house of the parliament, of the federal parliament, and that's they still do comparatively. But as PK says, are we? How big is this moment of realignment we are looking at? We've seen it occur, and when it does start to occur very quickly in other countries, but we're not quite sure. What is happening here? We have a slightly different system of parliament. We have compulsory voting. We have a few buffers, if you like, to that kind of avalanche of change. But clearly what we have seen change already has been a significant shift in the voting amongst the on the right side of politics. How far will that go? How will that translate into seats? All that gets factored into what's a major party. But, you know, maybe a time in the future where Australia is not talking about major party, minor parties anymore. We're all about coalitions. And we've seen that happen across Europe too. So, you know, it is a moment of change, but we just don't know how big and how long term that change will be.
Yeah, that's right. Look, our next question comes from Zoe.
Hi, Fran and PK. Zoe from Perth here. Love the podcast, every episode. Everyone's talking about the right side of politics and Pauline Hanson, and I do understand why that's important. But I want to know about the left side of politics. What are the Greens doing? Are they talking to anyone? Who are they talking to? What are they up to? I feel they've always had quite a lot of policy positions. Are they taking advantage of this political moment where people are looking for different ideas, or are they squibbing it?
So interesting, Zoe. Look, I actually do think the Greens are at a bit of a crossroads at the moment, having observed them. I think they're still pretty stung by what happened where they lost some lower house seats at the last election when they wanted to be growing, not going backwards. There's a view among some of them that they did overreach, that there was a problem with their messaging, but there are others still in there. So that they're having their own disputes. They just don't get as much coverage over who do want them to be quite hardline on things. So there is a genuine thing going on. In terms of whether they're squibbing it, I give Larissa Waters, can I say, some real credit in terms of the way that she has been doing her business in the Senate. She's a true senator to start with, and a man, of course, was in the lower house, so a different kind of politician and leader of the Greens. So she's more of an old school leader of the Greens. She is a true pragmatist. She has got deals through and should be given credit for them. The super one recently, then, of course, there was also that the Greens had been holding off on. Then there was the EPBC Act. Like, we're talking about a pretty pragmatic Greens. And now that this budget will have, and it will, tax reform, there'll be changes to housing taxes, perhaps negative gearing, all of this. The Greens will keep pushing for it to go further, but you'll see again a pragmatic Greens, and you've got to give them some credit. They've put a lot of this stuff on the agenda, how they've pushed a lot of these issues. And so they're having more success, whether it's being noticed out there. Well, I don't know if the political times have suited them necessarily, but I do give them some credit for being pragmatic at the moment.
Yeah, pragmatic, that's true. I have done some deals with the government because, of course, they're in that prime position where the government can choose, you know, in the Senate anyway, coalition or Greens and independents. And the Greens are using that, and they've used it effectively so far, I think. I don't think they're squibbing it. I think it's just hard to get heard at the moment. There's such a lot going on with this war. But the Greens have been there putting forward proposals for a 25% windfall tax on gas, for instance, as a result of this, in this climate where prices are going so high and gas companies are going to be making a lot of money off that. So they are there chipping away. But yes, I think, you know, there's some very effective crossbenchers at the moment as well. And Allegra Spender has been putting forward detailed and really useful, I think, tax proposals. She's got a third paper coming up, I think. And so the Greens are sharing the limelight a bit because, yes, they've been pushing tax change, capital gains tax, things like that. But they're accompanying accompanied on those on that journey, on that story with some of these crossbenchers. So I think there's a bit of that going on. But I think you are right, PK. I think they're still trying to work out what went wrong so badly for them at the last election and how they're positioning themselves now. And, you know, Anthony Albanese doesn't like dealing with the Greens. Historically, he doesn't like the Greens at all because they've been trying to cut his lunches in his own seat for such a long time. But I think there is a workable relationship forming. We've seen that. If I was the Greens, I wouldn't get too comfy with it. But no. In effect, it takes us to our next question, actually. There's some symbiosis here. This next question is from Ash.
Hey, PK Fran. Ash from Nipaloon, Hobart. Love your show. I wanted to know, we talk about when the sun doesn't shine and the wind doesn't blow, but when the petrol doesn't fill and the oil doesn't flow, should we be talking about some good old baseline renewable energy? Thanks.
Should we be talking about some good old baseline renewable energy? Well, just to follow on from our last questions, the Greens are. They're saying this is a moment to take advantage of, you know, let's give more subsidies for electric vehicles. And the government has indeed, you know, taken off some tax burdens on electric vehicles coming from Europe. That was part of the EU trade deal that was done this week. Yes, I think in the short to medium term, once this war is over, that will, I think, turn people's minds more towards renewable energy, more towards electric vehicles, things like that, because people have been hit hard here at the Bowser, as we've talked about. But it's a funny thing, isn't it? In the short term, we've got the coalition, the opposition, pushing hard for more fossil fuels, for more sovereign capacity, to quote that word that PK was talking about yesterday, in terms of producing our own urea for fertilizer, for being more self-sufficient when it comes to our energy processing, our fuel processing, our own capacity to produce the diesel that this country, and this is what this has shown in highlights for all of us to see, that our country runs on diesel at the moment. That's how our freight is moved all around the country. And if this war doesn't get resolved soon, we are going to really notice it in terms of not just prices, but availability of fuel and other supplies. So in the short term, I think we're going to have a good hard look at what our diesel capacity is here onshore, what our storage capacity is onshore. But longer term, I think it does and it should rev up the emphasis and the energy for green energy, whether that will or not. Climate Minister Chris Bowen has been under a lot of pressure through this, and I don't think he's coming out of it well so far. So let's see how it all plays out. But I think it's a short-term move to say, let's just have more fossil fuels. This is what this shows up. That's what I think.
Yeah. Okay. Another question. This one's from Alex.
Hi, Party Rumours. I was listening to Patricia and David talk about the upcoming budget, and it got me thinking about the vibe of tax reform. Like, given how badly negative gearing reform has landed in the past, do you think the real barrier was the policy or the way it was sold by politicians? Cheers.
Yeah, the way it was sold by politicians. Yes and no. Yes, the sales job previously, 2019, obviously, for Labor was not good. Also not good because there was just too much. Remember, it's not just this. It's not like they only talked about this. Franking credits, which no one even understood and allowed, you know, the biggest scare campaign. Then there was a made-up one by the opposition, you know, and basically implying there would be even death taxes, which was never on the agenda, by the way. It's an idea some people think is a good idea. Hello, let's have debates about all sorts of things. But it was never one of their policies. So, it was sold badly. But also my biggest take on this is sometimes you got to be patient, guys, and you have to wait for a consensus to build. So perhaps that consensus hadn't built yet. I feel like it's very cooked now. There is a strong consensus for it, and I'll give you the best example and evidence of that. Earlier this week, I had Andrew Hastie on my show on Afternoon Briefing. I talked to him about negative gearing and capital gains tax changes. His party is officially saying they don't think it's a good idea to make those changes, that it would be higher taxes. Guess what Andrew Hastie told me? He thinks it's worth considering. And he will be making arguments inside Shadow Cabinet about what he thinks, because he thinks there's an intergenerational issue and young people are being stung. So That, my friends, is because a consensus is built around housing, around young people. Fran?
Yeah, but that consensus, I missed that hasty interview with you, but that's interesting because Tim Wilson is not of that position. That is not the Coalition's position or the Liberal Party's position anyway on a capital gains tax. You know, that they're using that to say Labor will always hit you harder with taxes. They'll always tax you more and spend more. Yeah, you know, you mentioned the sales job done by Bill Shorten back in 2019. I don't think that Bill Shorten's sales job on those taxes, negative gearing and capital gains tax, were bad. I think they could have got it through. I think you're right. There was too much going on. They threw in that imputation tax credit thing. And also they were intransigent. They wouldn't compromise. They wouldn't bring in sunset clauses and things like that because they thought they could get it through. They were just a bit too confident they could get it through. But in the end, it was too much. They were raising too much money, spending too much money, and people weren't there yet because we weren't there yet in this moment of intergenerational inequity. That's the thing that has changed. We're all very aware that younger Australians are looking at perhaps, you know, being less well off than their parents or their grandparents even, that they're unable to buy houses and a lot of them thinking they'll never be able to buy a house. The thing is skewed too much, the superannuation, a whole lot of things are needing to change. And this is one big signal, even if it won't alter the balance in the housing market that much, and plenty of economists say it doesn't make that much difference. It is a big signal, and this Labor government, I think, is ready to signal to this huge block of young voters that, yes, we hear you, the tax system needs to change, it's got inbuilt unfairness, and we're doing something about that, and that's why they'll move on it. So I think that's the sales job we're going to see, Alex. And, you know, it's all about the sales job. It's all about, too, the opposition's sales job, how well they can do at demolishing it. And Tim Wilson, you might remember back in the years past, he did very well at tearing down that, you know, tax credit scheme we were mentioning before. He labelled it the pensioner's tax, I think. And so, you know, there's two sales jobs going on and it's always a matter of who does it better. But I think the government's got the biggest hook at the moment with intergenerational equity.
Yeah, I think they do. And I think this is their moment. And if they don't take it, people will wonder, what were they doing? That's it for the Party Room today. Keep sending your questions in because we do love getting them. We're fond of your voice notes. So as we've heard you today and we've enjoyed you, you've all got lovely voices. thepartyroom@abc.net.au is where to email us.
And a good friend of the podcast, Melissa Clark, will be back in the feed filling in for David Spears on Insiders on Background on Saturday. She's going to be speaking to Chris Richardson, an economist we all know and love. He knows plenty, especially about budgets, so I'd be tuning in. And then back to you for Politics Now on Monday, PK.
That's right. That is the final sitting week before the budget, so lots to say there. National Cabinet Day as well, so we'll know quite
a bit. Is that like a UN day, National Cabinet?
National Cabinet Day. I don't know. It's funny, actually. We'll add this. I spoke to Dan Tehan on Afternoon Briefing as well, and I said, what do you want from the government? Because they want daily updates of where the petrol's missing. And
more COVID,
yeah,
right?
Well, I said, do you want like daily updates? We've got the fuel and the PM. And he's like, yeah, what's wrong with that? And I'm thinking, ooh, I reckon the government's been careful about doing that because they don't want to trigger those memories and they're worried about the psychology. But let's see if we end up seeing that. Anyway, Monday, definitely National Cabinet Day. Follow Politics Now on ABC Listen. You won't miss an episode. See you, Fran.
See you, PK.